Though dances, I am still. Peace is my companion. Joy is my friend. The campfire, the stars, the slight breeze, the taste of the hot chocolate, and the dancing shadows are, in themselves, enough. Here I am. Why waste time wanting to be somewhere else? Join me by the campfire.
Hello, everybody. I am Aaron Simmons, and this is another episode of Campfire Philosophy with J. Aaron Simmons. Thank you all so much for joining us here by the campfire. I've got some more stuff here. There's some hot dogs left over from a little while ago, so cannot wait for you guys to hang out with us tonight. I am especially excited tonight because this is the first episode where I am only going to be sitting here at the campfire with one official guest, and That's a big deal. So every other episode, we've had a variety of folks with us, all amazing, all top tier scholars doing wonderful, wonderful work. It's been an honor to be with all of them. But tonight I have called in some deep favors with my friend, Tim Whitaker. And I was like, bro,
yes,
we're going to an episode with just me and you.
Yes. And, AKA a text on a Friday. Yo, man, you want to come on the show Monday night? Okay, bro. Sounds good.
Behind the curtain, not only are there no wizards, there's barely any planning.
I feel, dude, so that's my life. Like today, I post videos or podcasts now 3 times a week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday.
Oh my gosh.
And I don't ask why I said yes to that. But and Wednesday is always kind of like a response concept. So I'm responding to something. Well, I really had nothing at all. I'm like, you know, we'll just skip a week. And then last night I see this guy's video and I'm like, that's the video. So I spend all day today making the video, trying to edit it ready for tomorrow so I can post it for Wednesday. Oh, there's no plan. Right. The content is not, months out. It's just, this is a good video. I got to record it.
That's right. Well, I get it. I mean, the plan was, I was originally wanting to get you on an episode about Christian nationalism, which is still in the works. I'm working with Mike Austin, who has an amazing book coming out about Christian nationalism. Going to have some amazing guests. So that one's coming. But last week and the week before, we've been talking very, very intentionally about democracy, about political philosophy, about how public intellectuals can speak into those spaces and especially can bring a kind of heightened awareness of civil discourse and what that involves when it comes to like argumentative engagement, right? And in doing that, I thought, well, shoot, I want to do an episode after those 2 weeks on democracy and, you know, the sky is falling kind of debates, where we're able to think about something that is certainly not removed from those questions, but invites us to think about a little bit different space. And that's this idea of deconstruction. And so inviting you to think with me about deconstruction was my attempt to offer a kind of very, very substantive palate cleanser to the idea of, you know, democracy and civil discourse. Now let's actually spend a little bit thinking about God and who we are and how that affects the way that we then relate to each other, right? And so that was the hope. That's why I've shifted you from a group chat about nationalism to a one-on-one conversation about what do we even mean by deconstruction? What is this stuff? And so, man, so stoked to have you.
So why did you invite me on for these questions when you're the philosopher and I am the some college person? Like, help me understand. I mean, dude, I literally have a Jacques Derrida book here. Oh, here, look, I have this one. This is Deconstruction in a Nutshell, a conversation with Jacques Derrida, edited with commentary by John D. Caputo. I got 15 pages into the intro. I'm like, this guy's intro is like 75 pages. I can only understand some of it, like a haunting, hauntology. Mm-hmm. I'm like, okay,
hauntology.
Yeah, that's hauntology. Right. Okay, yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. And then I'm like, well, I guess I'm a loser because I don't understand any of this. So
I'm out.
Yes, let's talk about deconstruction by the guy who has no clue.
No, man. So it actually turns out those of you who, you know, Tim needs no introduction to hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people who are part of his movement called the New Evangelicals.
Too kind.
I have been unbelievably honored to be on his podcast, The New Evangelicals. And in fact, let me make sure to throw a link up so you guys can definitely get connected to the work he's doing and all the amazing stuff.
Wow, look at that QR code. That's nice.
This is what happens when you've got a producer behind the scenes who teaches you how to do stuff.
Wait, there's a little animation there too. What, dude?
Right? It for people who are listening to this on Spotify, I'm telling you, you are missing out not being part of the live stream.
You got a producer for this thing?
He sought me out. Amazing, amazing man named Daniel Sanderson. We're going to hear about him later in the work he's doing over at Plank Sip. But yeah, he reached out to me and he's like, dude, we've got to get a podcast up and running. I'm going to teach you how to do it. I'm going to give you access to all kinds of graphics.
Look at
that. He's amazing.
Amazing.
Unbelievable. Don't let Daniel hear you say that. His ego may get very high thinking now that he is in fact God. So,
well, to be fair, the graphics kind of crappy. It's not my favorite. So there you go. I brought my down to earth,
This is like one of the lesser deity graphics.
I've seen better graphics. I'm just saying, but it's not bad. Yeah.
No. So the work you're doing at New Evangelicals, I mean, I got familiar with your work probably 3 years ago. And it was actually fairly recently after you got it started.
Yeah.
And our mutual friend, Trip Fuller,
yeah,
who of course has done for years and years and years, homebrewed Christianity, working in a space that in some ways didn't exist when he was working in it, right? So originally his stuff was, you know, what happens if we talk about philosophy of religion in kind of broad sweeping ways and invite cool guests on and open conversations about things that maybe we don't get to talk about in churches. And then this big thing started happening called deconstruction in a popular religious space.
Right.
Then the ex-evangelical movement. And all of these different terms and isms and stuff that has been throwing around, he now finds himself, of course, as like one of the leaders of a space that in many ways happened around what he was already doing, right? In your case, you found yourself in a space very personally, struggling with some things, wrestling with stuff, crying out into the void. And it turns out it wasn't a void. It was a very, very thick soup of lots of folks saying, oh my goodness, I'm right there with you. Maybe tell a little bit about kind of how that got going just for people who aren't familiar with New Evangelicals, because this is, I think, the best way to answer why would I invite you to talk to me about deconstruction? Because deconstruction, I think, means two things.
Yeah.
A philosophical thing and a religious thing.
Right.
And that's what I want to kind of parse out with you tonight. So yeah, tell us a little bit how you got into that and then we'll back into the big question.
Well, the real short version is in December of 2020, I just got to a point in my faith as a white evangelical where I said, I think we need a new evangelical movement. It was kind of sparked after witnessing years of the Trump and MAGA movement and watching the response to Black Lives Matter and the response to COVID, reading a little bit more widely than what I was kind of initially reading, right? So for a long time, Rob Bell was Mr. Edgy. And so I started kind of even reading beyond him, which I know is crazy for some people.
Falling off the edge.
Oh, really? Yeah, exactly. And it was really a culmination of just so many things that made me go, I'm so tired of whatever it is that I'm a part of. It doesn't seem like it's very Jesus-centric at all. And we need a new evangelical movement. That was a thought in my head that sparked the idea of the New Evangelicals. Now, I was a volunteer at a church in South Jersey, New Jersey, the south part of it. We divide the state, North Jersey, South Jersey. Central Jersey does not exist. And if anyone tells you that, they're lying, just so you know. I'm just a no-name volunteer. I'm not even a full-time staff person, never have been. I just was always one of these like very hungry amateur theologian types. I just really enjoyed this stuff. And so I was kind of freaked out to start an Instagram account with the name because the name just felt so audacious, like the new evangelicals. Like who's this bro coming in? But long story short, I started it in December of 2020 in my attic. I just made an Instagram post. Hey guys, my name's Tim. This is the New Evangelicals. Yeah. And very quickly I realized, oh, I'm not alone in these questions. And then I discovered the term deconstruction for the first time being used online, the ex-evangelical movement. And then, of course, you know, the rest is kind of history. It just kind of blew up from there. And now I do this full time. But yeah, it has been quite the journey. But yes, my foray into the term deconstruction came from the pop ex-evangelical sense, not from the philosophical sense at all.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think this is important because when this term started showing up, I don't exactly know when. I'm sure, you know, somebody could tell us. But for me, it became a thing that I started noticing, especially on YouTube. Kind of, you know, 2018, 19-ish, I started seeing a lot more of these sorts of stories. Probably was going on before that, but it really, I think, hit a kind of critical mass and tipped over to where what deconstruction now means, if you were to just, you know, type it into Google. is probably not going to be the philosophy of Jacques Derrida and associated thinkers. It's going to be something having to do with religious people rethinking their religion in exceptionally critical ways, with an eye toward trying to find a different possibility by which their religiosity, their faith journey can make sense for them, given a social space that is now more inclusive, that is more hospitable, that is, as you put it, more Jesus-centric. Because part of, I think, what started happening was a frustration with, well, if this is what Christianity looks like, that's not something I find very compelling. And so the deconstruction is a move away from the less compelling stories that they had been taught toward something that might be a renewed religious engagement. Does that sound right? Or how?
Yeah, I think just putting it simply, it was a moment where people said, I need to re-examine beliefs that I held as unmovable religiously, right? And so, and you know, I call it, some people call it a movement, and it's not. It's an explosion because people go in different directions. They land in different places. But I think, at least from my experience, the work that I do, a lot of people were not having a crisis of faith. They were having a crisis of theology, right? It wasn't so much like, do I believe if God exists or do I believe in Jesus? It was, what God do I believe in? What Jesus do I believe in? What do I do with these questions that I've been given answers to that aren't making sense regarding my lived experience or the lived experience of my neighbors, right? And so I think a lot of people just saw the term deconstruction as a really easy way of kind of encompassing, like, yeah, I am really tearing down some old beliefs and replacing them with potentially some new ones. I don't know what they are yet, but I need permission to do this. And people picked up, I think, on that term, and they all kind of found each other online. I really had no idea about this term, and all of a sudden I'm like, whoa, there's a whole world here that's only about 5 months ahead of me tops. So it's been very interesting that I timed it that way, completely out of the blue. But I definitely think that's a good way of putting it, for sure. It's definitely, I know that there are some philosophical overtones. You know, I think that some of the concepts you can find from the groundwork that folks like Jacques Derrida laid mm-hmm. for sure. But none of us really knew that. None of us knew who Jacques Derrida was. And the first time I heard of Jacques Derrida was when Matt Chandler did his, like, deconstructing isn't biblical. It's from a postmodern philosopher named Jacques Derrida. And I'm like, oh, who's that guy? So I start Googling, you know, who is Jacques Derrida? That's kind of my intro into whoever that guy is, you know?
Well, and it's weird because when I started hearing the term show up in this popular sense, and for our purposes, let's just refer to that as religious deconstruction as opposed to philosophical, right? Just give us some ease of terms. But this religious deconstruction, it really bugged me, but it bugged me not as a Christian. It bugged me as a philosopher. I was like, y'all stop using this term.
I'm pretty sure that was our first conversation. I had you on the podcast to talk about that.
I think that's right. And and it's tricky because there has been, and this is, I think, some of the stuff that maybe some of the kind of intellectual figures associated with religious deconstruction are certainly trained in philosophical movements, and they can kind of parse some of this, but I don't think that it's percolated down in a kind of mass awareness way. Right. There's been this thing called deconstructive philosophy of religion for decades. And one of the figures you mentioned, John Caputo, was, of course, one of the main voices there, but also people like Merrill Westfall, Richard Carney, they're Jeff Blokel. There's a whole group who was doing this sort of work. And all of that work, in a very, I think, compelling way, is modeling what it looks like to interrogate, as you put it, what we formerly held as sacrosanct, obvious, certain, and unchallengeable.
Yeah, and that's why I say that without knowing it, there's probably some overtones that someone like yourself could pick up on and say, oh, yeah, like, there actually is some resemblance here. I mean, and I don't – far be it from me to make philosophical claims in front of a philosopher who knows his shit. But what one of my understandings loosely is that, you know, the term deconstruction in the philosophical sense lets us think about words being a little more flexible, how context and culture kind of shapes the meaning of those words, and how words can take on new meaning. And so if that hypothesis or statement is correct, it's kind of interesting because to a point we're kind of proving Jacques Derrida's point that, like words can be flexible, even the word deconstruction itself, right? Taking on a kind of a new meaning in its cultural moment and context based on a new group of people saying, this word really helps me think about it this way, mm-hmm. while maybe Jacques Derrida or whoever else had very different understandings or even intentions right. for how they were using that word.
Yeah, I mean, now you're sounding like, again, our mutual friend Tom Ord,
love
who
Tom.
Has fussed at me for several years, because I keep saying, Tom, stop using this word. Like, we need to find a different word. Let's call it religious deconstruct. Like, you know, give an adjective, right? Do something, put an asterisk next to it.
Sure, sure.
Deconstruction one and two, something, just because what we philosophers have been doing in deconstructive philosophy of religion certainly is this deep resource out of which a lot of what now is being called religious deconstruction, it's certainly like anticipating and giving rise to why this would make sense. But it's really, really important for those of us, and here I'll speak from my own experience, those of us who have fought for deconstructive philosophy of religion to be taken seriously in philosophy of religion, y'all are not helping. Like, this is making this so hard, because philosophy of religion is a very technical specialist subfield, and experts engage in these debates. For the vast majority of 20th century philosophy of religion, anything associated with, you know, the kind of broadly, here I'll use some technical term, but kind of continental or existential mm-hmm. or phenomenological veins, where deconstruction then comes out of, these were not mainstream discourses for philosophy of religion. They were very marginal, and in many ways viewed as a kind of anathema to serious philosophical scholarship, right? Mm-hmm. And so those of us who had been in that space, drawing on existentialism and deconstruction and stuff, saying, no, philosophy of religion as a broader discourse among professionals can be made really, you know, it's expanded. It's more interesting when we have these other discourses upon which to draw. And in particular, it's a very cool way of diversifying the field, because part of the problem in philosophy of religion is it traditionally has looked an awful lot like philosophy of classical Christian theism. And so part of what deconstruction helps us do is say, what do we even mean by this thing we call religion? What kind of history does this concept have? How does it get deployed? And once we started interrogating our terms, our concepts in the field, then it makes philosophy of religion more compelling. But if what this stuff now means is a bunch of, and again, this is not dismissive, I'm talking about the assumption that people had, a bunch of millennials who are kind of pissed off because their parents aren't as LGBTQ forward as them, mm-hmm. jumping ship and getting mad about church, all like the philosophy people were, my goodness, that's so not what we're talking about. It's something else. And so for me, there was a very real worry that this was going to make the philosophical debates harder to deploy, harder to engage. Right?
Yeah, but why would it though? Here's why I ask that, because my understanding is that there's a pretty big delta between like the academy and like what happens in those spaces and what happens on like the pop culture level, right? So I would imagine that even these philosophers of religion who might see this other, whatever the term you just used, this other deconstruction type philosophy. That's my lowbrow level way of explaining it. But like, if they saw you as the redheaded stepchild, I would still imagine they'd be able to parse out how someone like myself is using it online to describe me rebelling against my evangelicalism. They would go, well, obviously that's not what Aaron Simmons means by this. You know, even though I might disagree, I don't hold them responsible for this.
Think of it as a gateway drug, man. So part of the worry about deconstruction for lots of years, even before it was a Phil Religion set of debates, was that this was actually wrecking philosophical rigor. This was leading us toward a kind of slippery, anything goes relativism, right? And so Derrida took all kinds of heat from mainstream analytic philosophers.
Right.
In fact, there was a famous letter written when he was up for an honorary doctorate from a university in the UK. And, you know, all these philosophers said, he's not a real philosopher. This stuff is garbage. It's just literary criticism, etc. And so given that history, the idea that, well, now this deconstructive philosophy of religion stuff, it really just is like Catholicism for atheists, as one of my friends referred to it years ago. Like this just is a kind of form of, we can talk about God, but we don't really mean this stuff. And so when that started becoming popularized, the worry from me and some of my friends in the field was not, hey, this is ours. There's no territorialism.
Right.
It was, wait a minute. Part of what we've been told is this is just a slippery slope toward abandoning any real rigorous discourse about traditional concepts in philosophy of religion and
Tim
theology.
Whitaker and Trip Fuller and Tom Ord with their open relational theology is proving the point.
Sending us off the edge right now. Now we're all hanging out and serious theology becomes beer camp.
Let me ask you a question.
It was a mess.
Okay. This is helpful because I mean, this is a context, like I've said many times, I kind of stumbled into this whole deconstruction terminology and was kind of forced to throw myself into it because of the work I was doing. People were asking me questions, which means I had to find experts. So I got you or Bruce Benson on the podcast, right? People can kind of help ground some of this stuff. That's helpful. One of my questions, though, is give me a second to kind of parse this out so I can really express it. Good. But this mode of philosophy aside, like, let's just toss it out for just one second. There is a human tradition, let alone religious tradition, of, you know, people changing beliefs about religion and how we understand God based on new and relevant information. I mean, Martin Luther is the easiest one, right? I mean, Protestant reformer. Pretty much is like, you know what, the Catholic Church is the anathema here. And back to the Bible, sola scriptura, not a huge fan of James and Revelation, but I guess we'll keep it in, you know, has this whole new kind of way of thinking about God that sets the stage for a lot of what even we're doing now today, right? I don't think that Martin Luther had deconstruction or Jacques Derrida or whatever kind of philosophy that we're talking about today in his mind, but he still rethought and renegotiated, we could say, his relationship to his faith tradition and kind of birth something entirely new out of it. Right. So while I understand, I guess to a degree, the critique by some of these more, you know, stoic mainline philosophers, I guess we can say at the same time, like humans and humanity and human history does move by philosophy, right? Like the previous tradition of philosophers have shaped how we think about even philosophy today. So why would they be scared or nervous or feel like we can't do this with a new mode of philosophy when that's just kind of how humanity has been with these kinds of thoughts?
Yeah. So think of it. And I forgot to mention this earlier. Everyone who's watching, drop comments in whatever live stream channel and platform you are on.
Yeah.
We'd love to incorporate your comments, your thoughts, what we're up to here.
Are you live streaming this on YouTube?
Yes, this is live streaming on YouTube.
Okay, listen, YouTube people, you need to like this video. Here's how this works. Okay, let me give you some creator back end. If you like a video as you're watching it, it tells YouTube, oh, this person likes this video. And YouTube will then push that video out organically to more people. So the more likes a video gets, the more it helps that creator's content get out there. And frankly, it's not every day you come across a philosopher that is the caliber of Aaron Simmons. So I'm just saying, the fact that he's doing this stuff accessible to many people makes pushing his content out there. So move your little hand and hit the like button. You can do it. It's totally free. It costs you nothing, but make sure you do it. There you go.
Thank you. Thank you. And I should note for everybody listening, not finding a philosopher of my caliber can be heard in lots of ways. So that might have been Tim's nuanced shade, shall we say. But no, I appreciate it. Yes. Do like, would love to invite everybody to be part of this community. And part of what I think so important here is, right, your question is, look, hasn't philosophy always progressed? It's always rethought where it was.
Yeah.
And in one sense, of course, Aristotle critiques Plato, who critiques Socrates. And this very trajectory is part of what gives rise to why Alfred North Whitehead could say of Western philosophy, it's just a long series of footnotes to Plato, right? The worry about, well, why is this any different? Like, why that maybe misses something important is, notice what starts happening, especially in the late 19th century and early 20th century in the philosophical tradition, primarily we're talking about here in the Western context. A lot of, shall we say, interrogations of the assumptions of the authority structures by which the discourse of philosophy had traditionally been conducted. So it's not just that we are asking questions about what somebody else had said, they start asking questions about the very categories and concepts and authorities by which the conversation had been occurring.
Right.
So you start getting Nietzsche saying, what do we even mean by this God business? Maybe God is dead. You get Kierkegaard coming in saying, shoot, maybe faith is actually radical subjective investment. You have people like Freud show up and say, it might be the case that our conscious mind and our very sense of self is radically undermined by what is repressed underneath the surface of our, you know, cognition. And this continues. We get people from Ricoeur to Gadamer saying hermeneutics is a complicated thing. What do we even mean by this? And then, of course, it expands out in, I think, productive ways. But French feminism, queer theory, critical race theory, all these different discourses show up not saying we disagree with your claim that P or X. It's we're not sure that the structure by which P or X can even be articulated holds up. And those critical interrogations are the problem.
Right? I get that. And what's the problem? What's the problem with that? I mean, again, like, what is this one of these, like, the Western civilization has been based upon these people and we can't undermine these core foundations? I don't know. I'm not the expert here. I'm just struggling with the idea of what is wrong with checking our assumptions. I mean, I think, for example, critical race theory, one of the beautiful gifts it's given us is being able to see past just what's on the letter of the law, but how racism and systemic racism is still manifest in different places, right? And how it impacts through law, but also through culture and other things, and how it continues on. I guess I'm just struggling with what are these people so afraid of by someone asking about the nature of P or X, so to speak, instead of just doing the footnote thing to Aristotle. Is that who you said it was? I don't know. I don't read these guys.
Plato.
What are they afraid that, like, you know, we're just going to nuke the whole world and, like, America's going to go away? Like, what are we actually afraid of that make us go, we can't do that? It's untouchable. Why?
Yeah.
I don't get it.
Well, so let's, I think this is a really important question because this is one of the spots where philosophical and religious deconstruction, I really do think, come together in important ways. So why is it? So I'm not dodging the question. I'm going to try to
typical philosopher.
It.
Yeah. I
was told recently by somebody that nuance is the philosopher's way of simply dismissing other people. And I was like, oh my gosh, that's so wrong.
No, I'm a big nuance guy. Go for it. I'm fine with that.
But so let me ask you this. So in the attempt to unpack why is the death of God, the rise of psychoanalysis, the rise of critical theory, like why are these things so concerning to a discourse that has built its history on the stability of a few things like truth, reason, objectivity, selfhood, right? These types of categories are the ones that now start getting interrogated, questioned. And in the process, we start also recognizing that the discourse, as Richard Rorty says, is just one more game humans can play with language instead of what had traditionally been seen as, no, philosophy is the foundational task of human inquiry, right? So all of this stuff is starting to occur. Let me, though, put a pin there and ask you, why are pastors worried about the questions that in many cases the youth of their churches are beginning to ask, or the deconstructive people are starting to bring and say, but wait a minute, why this, how that? What is it that you're finding pastors are saying back? My hunch is there might be some overlap.
Well, I mean, I could just tell you that this is my understanding. Okay, these are my thoughts, my opinion on this based on just hearing from DMs and hearing pastors. I don't think a lot of them think about this, but you know, a lot of the tradition that we grew up in was built on high control religious environments, right? It's not a mode of like being okay with the uncertainty or like living in the gray of things or realizing how things are complicated. It was very black and white. This is good. This is bad. This is true. This is false. Here's what you believe. And then that ends up creating environments where the people who control the information and tell you how to think about it are the ones that are kind of in control of your life. And so even though a lot of these pastors probably don't have the eyes to see this, I think a lot of it does come down to power and control and how they're able to kind of do that. Now, what I'm not saying is that most pastors are intentionally trying to control or manipulate their parishioners. As someone who was a white evangelical for a long time, who helped lead small groups when we were all not married, I wanted to help people stay pure by keeping them accountable because they wanted that, right? Again, I wasn't trying to control people, but that's exactly what I was doing based on my understanding of purity and God, et cetera. And so I say all that because in my mind, what has happened is that, to your earlier point about like these different categories of truth, objectivity, one of the things that I've realized, and this is kind of after thinking about this for a few years now, is it seems like the evangelical tradition I grew up on inverted those things. For example, right? I tell people often to kind of demonstrate this. There's a reason why in academia, there's no such thing as a flat earth department. Like, we're not really debating a flat earth. Well, why? Because we can use the scientific method. We can use science. We can even now fly up to outer space and we can observe and prove that the earth is indeed round. Like, it's not a subjective thing. It is an objective truth about the universe. And we can verify that to prove that it's true. Religion, philosophy, let's just say religion, because that's what I'm more comfortable saying. I feel like it's much more of a conversation. How do we understand these things that are not so clear, that are not so objective? We don't really have the level of evidence or certainty that we might have with around Earth, for example, right? And I was kind of sold almost the opposite, where I was sold that like this Christian tradition and this Bible are the objectively true foundations for how I live my life morally, even scientifically to a degree with like young earth creationism, et cetera, right? And even historically. And that I really couldn't trust what the world's logic was. Like, you know, I really couldn't watch a whole lot of Bill Nye the Science Guy. Whenever someone said that the earth was formed over billions of years old, I couldn't watch that. I couldn't watch Captain Planet because Mother Nature.
Yeah.
I'm not saying my parents were bad people. I'm not saying that at all. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying these categories were flipped for me. Right.
Yeah.
And I think I'm looking at this and I'm going, I understand why people would be like, well, what is objectivity or what is even truth, given how it was presented, to me, and how I found out that the truth of that was that their truth was actually not very true at all, or at least highly subjective. Right. And case in point, just to prove this, Sean McDowell, he's an evangelical apologist. Okay. I've talked to him before on the podcast. He's very nice, very cordial. In my opinion, one of the few good faith apologists in that world. And I asked him flat out, can we objectively prove that the resurrection happened?
Yeah.
He says, no, we can't do that. I go, okay, thank you. Then why was it sold to me like it was? why was it sold to me like it was? When even you, an evangelical apologist, does not like using that level of category. Right now, he might say, to what degree of certainty? I'm all about measurements of certainty. That's fine. But I was not told about the resurrection in terms of degrees of certainty. It was either liar, Lord, or lunatic, bro.
All in or all out.
So does that kind of give context why, to me, on the outside, when I hear you say those things, I'm like, yeah, why would we not want to integrate those things? Like, I'm all about rethinking the foundations that have given us these categories. Because in my experience, I found them very lacking with how they were presented to me as a Christian.
Yeah, no, it makes tons of sense. And I think you're hitting on what I would say as two different strands that we could kind of pull at, right? And this is back to the philosophical debates, but I really do think that they mirror what's going on in the power structures of the religious, you know, establishment, right? On the one hand, your account that ultimately the reason, you know, pastors or, you know, those with authority in the churches might be very resistant to this thing called deconstruction is because, as you say, it's a threat to a kind of control model. Right. And that's exactly right. And this, by the way, certainly want to make sure that I mention it as we go. One of the books that I think has recently been published that better than anything else I've read shows us how that control model functions as a kind of authoritative notion of God that then plays out to a, we might say, sympathy toward more authoritarian political commitments is our mutual friend John Sanders' book, Embracing Prodigals. So for anybody, I figured that our conversation was going to hit on some of these topics. Please go check out John Sanders' new book, Embracing Prodigals, because what he talks about is this idea that, look, when we want to control think about this like in terms of parenting. If we want to control our kids such that obedience becomes the maximal model of their loyalty to our self-righteousness, right? Then what we will do is instill in them a moral compass guided where North looks just like allegiance to the parent.
Right.
If alternatively, we want to create in our kids, let's say what Sanders's word is a nurturant model of parenting, whereby we are saying, look, I'm not about controlling. I'm about trying to be critical when you need the right kind of chastisement because you're going off the rails. We had some comments saying, can't philosophy just go way off the rails? It absolutely can. And there's been movements that have really kind of just been dead ends. They've hit cul-de-sacs and the kind of guild has pulled back from them. Nurturant parents aren't just permissives. They are actively trying to say, let me try to help and correct. But I'm doing this because I want to inspire in you your own creativity to figure out what might be the case, what could occur.
Right.
So be loyal, not to me and my word, but be loyal to the commitments that I've tried to model in my own life to invite you to then live into yours with, you know, a virtuous commitment to excellence. Right. So I think that same kind of dichotomy plays out in not just philosophy, but academic spaces. There are power structures among people with PhDs that in many ways are harder to see because it looks like we're all just engaging in argument. But often what's happening is, well, whose arguments get considered and with in what journals? And well, how does the peer review process work? And we don't take those things through. You're citing those people? Well, that's just garbage out of the gate, right? So part of why I think there was a resistance to this deconstructive movement in philosophy, which, as you say, at its most basic is an interrogation of the modes by which meaning is taken as stable and fully encapsulated and articulate in our language. And deconstruction says, but the stability is itself a facade occurring internal to our linguistic utterances. The more we use terms, the more we stabilize them. But the problem is, in stabilizing them, they start kind of resisting the straitjacket and they start slipping out from under our thumb. And that's where we start, as Derrida sees or suggests, we should let language start playing and allow us to realize stuff can be way more interesting if we aren't trying to control our discourse, but letting the discourse kind of unfold and see what happens. The worry is, and this is the second thread I think you talked about, right? So the first is control. People that have control want to keep it. And those who lack it tend to understand themselves as excluded from that space in ways that might be accurate. It also might be the case that they're a kind of, well, we're going to go off and do our own thing in resistance rather than continuing to have to fight the battles in rigorous ways. The second worry, though, is, but look, even if there's this control narrative, even if the philosophers can be, you know, really cocky and arrogant in all kinds of insular ways, it's also the case, as you put it, but why wouldn't we all benefit from letting degrees of certainty be in play instead of dichotomies, instead of binaries? Don't these binaries tend to shut down what might actually be true? And that's, I think, entirely why more and more and more, what we would call analytic philosophers, are starting to turn to some of these critical theoretical resources, including deconstruction, because they're starting now to realize, well, shoot, this actually helps us in our real commitments, whether it be feminism, disability studies, whatever the case may be. We can be better at this when we recognize that our own discourse may have closed down the possibilities from the outset. Mm-hmm. And this is Derrida's big, big, big critique. When we break meaning, the world, the real, into a binary, that binary will now itself start undermining the stability of all the work we're trying to do in light of that binary. it just doesn't hold up real well. And so it's kind of like, if, you know, a mundane example, you and I say, oh, well, do you like music or do you like country? Right. Well, notice what that dichotomy is doing. I have no great love for country music. And yet the way I've framed it is country is non-music. And so then you've got people that think, well, wait a minute. No, I love country, but then it forces them to be a music hater. Like, when we start dichotomizing the categories, we eliminate the play that actually happens when people talk to each other and realize that their own experience may not be the only possibility in play. And that's, I think, something that's happening religiously among millions of folk and has happened for decades in the philosophical guild as well.
Well, and it feels like when you combine that with the awakening many of us are having, that, you know, our current American structure came from somewhere, privileged some voices at the expense of others, which voices get to set the cultural norms, and which voices don't, which bodies are seen as exotic, which hairstyle is seen as unique, right, compared to what's normal. You can see the connection of like how all these things start riffing off of each other, where you go, well, wait, like if things are not as binary and there are power structures, which is, I mean, to a degree, it's just a human condition that we've always had. But if some people do set the rules for others, that means that some bodies are seen as normal in a culture versus ones that aren't. So in our cultural context, who's setting those rules and who's benefiting and who's not benefiting, right? And then you start asking those questions, which I think are very fair and reasonable, and then you get called a Marxist. You're like, wait, a Marxist? I'm just asking. I don't have any conclusion yet. I'm just asking the question. And dare I advocate for a more equitable world, especially given the fact that in the American context, we are, you know, just a few decades beyond not only race-based chattel slavery being allowed and being normalized, but also integration, or I'm sorry, segregation being legal, right? And so we just are a few decades beyond making those things illegal, let alone doing the deep systemic dive of how those processes and systems set our country up to really put some people ahead and keep some people behind, especially when you start looking at things like the average white family wealth amount versus, you know, the wealth gap compared to black families, right? You can see it's a massive number. I mean, I think it's like $28,000 for the average black family compared to like $100,000 or more for the average white family. And then what happens is, in my context, here's the solution you're given. Oh, well, you see, Tim, some people work harder than others, right? Some people just like to be lazy. They just don't work as hard as those other people. But then what happens is when you get in front of, or you listen to actual historians, people who know their shit, you go, wait a second, that's actually racist. Like, it's like, that's not it at all. That's not at all. That's not what's going on at all here. So I'm a little off the beaten path, but just to bring it back, you know,
no, this is great.
I'm just saying like this idea, this way of thinking, it starts to really pull a lot of the threads of maybe like the Matrix, we can say, of what you thought was normal and just always there. But weren't able to see what was animating all of this and who was benefiting versus who was not.
That's right. Well, so I, during COVID, did a YouTube video where I was cribbing off of Slayer. They have that great song Disciple, where the you know, some of our listeners might know this, but the chorus of which just says God hates us all. And I used that phrase, but flipped it and said, maybe God hates normal. And part of what I was trying to do is make this deconstructive point that you're doing such a good job of illustrating. It's not just the case that we can fall into the binary of, oh, well, there's lazy and there's hard workers. Well, that, of course, is true in some ways and not true in others. But it's also the case that there were redlining policies that were underwriting. Right. There was the, you know, Cross Bronx Expressway that created the South Bronx in a particular sense.
The Tulsa Race Massacre. Black Wall Street was torched. A lot of things.
Long-standing realities. Yeah. And so part of what that then does is says, what happens, and this is something I think that's really important for religious and philosophical deconstruction, is what work is the term God doing for us?
Exactly.
And part of what I think is so cool about this idea that maybe God hates normal is, well, typically we find ourselves, and those of us like you and I who grew up in predominantly white evangelical contexts, for what it's worth, and I have been public about this, I do not consider myself having deconstructed religiously, but not because I haven't rethought and recontextualized and, you know, interrogated these beliefs, but because that was something I was doing, like, while writing books of philosophy. It wasn't something that I did in a, like, I'm wrestling with my faith and trying to figure out what's on the other side of it. And so I take too seriously that lots of folks have had that as an experiential fact for me to act like that also has been my experience. It's just different for me.
Well, can I also add here, this is actually a really important point. So yes, the God card comes in here, and I'm actually reading a great book by Scott Coley. He's also a philosopher. He's wonderful. He wrote a book called Ministers of Propaganda. I highly recommend it. He talks about the term legitimizing narratives. Ever heard of that term before? A legitimizing narrative? Yeah. So he talks about how right wing, especially like conservative evangelicals, have created these legitimizing narratives, and they use God to kind of justify these narratives, right? And as I'm reading his book, and he's kind of exposing the history of just like all the things, you know, racism and all that stuff, I'm like, oh, like, yes, these narratives are created about how society should work. Those society gets made in that image. The result is some people are at the top, some are at the bottom, and thus the cycle is complete. Look, there's the proof. And the example he uses is the very classic, deeply racist view that Black people were born inferior to white people. And so these narratives create society where these inequalities exist, redlining, all kinds of things like that, right? And then people point and say, look, there's proof. There's proof of this. Because the legitimizing narrative is the basis which the truth is based off of, right? And so go back to our context. Like, I'm not talking about the world. I'm not talking about history. In 2024 America, it turns out, Aaron, that white evangelicalism and Protestantism has a long, deep legacy of forming legitimizing narratives throughout American history that has historically kept some people, mainly folks like them, at the top of the pile, while historically keeping marginalized groups underneath of them. And they've used the God card and the Protestant faith and the inerrant Bible, all that kind of stuff, the curse of Ham. They've created all of these legitimizing narratives that they then sold to people as, this is what the Bible clearly teaches. The Bible is clear. This is a biblical worldview. Boom, it turns out you start reading this stuff and you go, wait a second, I hear that same language today, only it's aimed at queer people and trans people. It's aimed at everyone else who these people don't like. It's the same scaffolding. It's the same outline. You're just inserting different people groups every couple years to maintain the status quo, right? And so I think when you realize that, and your whole life you've been deeply committed to this version of Jesus, you start to realize, or you start to ask, what Jesus exactly was I following? Yeah. Because Jesus of the gospel accounts tells me to liberate the oppressed and doesn't like people who are mass incarcerated and wants us to and wants us to clothe the naked and wants us to heal the sick, right? That looks very different than white gun owning, the poor just don't work hard enough, provide for your own health care. Capitalism is great. Ignore the whole part about the rich man not being able to enter the kingdom. You know, ignore that. That's all metaphor. Jesus. And we go, something is not right here. Something is wrong. And then we start deconstructing. that's kind of how it goes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but again, notice what you're saying here is so cool. On the one hand, you're suggesting this need to reinforce the status quo is made visible by using God talk, deploying it in order to stress the, you use these words are exactly right ones, clarity that comes from an evidential set that is hotly contested, right? By even things like philosophers. And this is what's so interesting is this parallel. Like I was recently on a Facebook group where I made some comment about, look, folks, it was a religious group associated with the denomination in which I grew up. And they kept saying things like, but the Bible's clear that this, and the Bible's clear that that. And I came on and said, well, look, I'm not even here to try to disagree with you about your view. I am here, though, to just help you understand that some of the leading evangelical scholars are not all on the same page when it comes to what you're suggesting is just obvious and clear to everybody.
Oh my gosh. Like, exactly.
Guys, chill out. Maybe you're right. Maybe you are. All I'm suggesting is stop using this narrative of clarity to make impossible questions that are offered in good faith and usually reflecting a frustrated experiential data set that cannot find traction internal to this narrative of God's clearly said X, Y, and Z. Now, notice, neither of us are suggesting there isn't possibly some truth internal to these religious traditions. You and I both still identify as internal to those spaces. But doing so in a way that says, hey, maybe question marks are helpful here. Somebody earlier was saying that, you know, these blind alleys in philosophy can propel us to good places. And someone else said, well, how can there be both blind alleys that lead us places? I would want to suggest they don't lead us places if those blind alleys now are where we just set up shop,
right?
But if the blind alleys are like, oh, shoot, this can't be where we're going to keep going.
Right.
Let's turn around. Let's go differently, right? C.S. Lewis has this line where he says, when you get lost, the best thing you can do is find your way back to where you may have taken a wrong turn. And part of what I think you and I both would agree on is where some of the wrong turns have happened in American Christianity.
That's right.
They are things that lots of American Christians cite as foundational, like,
that's exactly
doctrines of the faith.
Well, right? And we have to be so clear here, right? Because we're not talking about you know, all Christianity in America. There's obviously many, many different strands, right? But when it comes to power, influence, money, networks,
yeah,
the white evangelical strand is the most powerful by far. I mean, they're the second largest voting bloc in America, et cetera. Yep. So I'm not saying, like, for example, the early Wesleyan tradition, the holiness tradition, right, wasn't really good in fighting for abolition and the Underground Railroad and ordaining women and being super socially conscious, right? Like, they were badasses. Yep. I read that book, Discovering an Evangelical Heritage by Donald Dayton. It's written in the 60s. I'm like, these are my people. Like, where have they been, right? So clearly there are... I would argue faithful Jesus following strands that are concerned about how we think about those most vulnerable among us and how we fight for more just both individual outcomes, but also systemic system and change. Yeah. Right. Or you think about James Cone and you think about the cross and lynching tree and how he just builds a powerful, I mean, brilliant, but powerful case about how every time a black person is lynched, we are crucifying Jesus. Right. Because
just
Jesus
this morning
was the marginalized.
Just this morning on my Substack, which I also hope people will go check out, Philosophy in the Wild, part of what I suggested was that black gospel music, I was talking about Kirk Franklin in particular, but this tradition actually has really important resonances with James Cone, with Slavoj Žižek, with Karl Marx, with all of these thinkers who are often seen as, you know, heretical, anathema, idolatrous. Right. It turns out that all of them were calling for what Kirk Franklin calls for when he says, do you want a revolution? Whoop, whoop. Like that reality is a revolution toward the justice that we hear about in the Minor Prophets, this idea of rolling down like waters. This is part of the tradition that we're tapping into to challenge where that tradition has recently landed.
I literally just interviewed James McGrath on his new book, John the Baptist, Christmaker. It's really powerful. Nice. And James McGrath is like a top tier scholar. You know, he knows his shit. And like he's talking about how after he took a year off to go to actual primary sources geographically to study all he could about what we know about John the Baptist. And one of the points he makes is that John the Baptist is kind of participating in this idea of he's riffing off of the earlier prophets saying the current religious establishment is problematic. God's more accessible than just inside the temple or forgiveness beyond just human, animal sacrifice, right? He's kind of upending the status quo, not to destroy it, but to call it back to its original purpose, right? And to push forward that the blessing of God is expanding beyond where we thought originally. Now this is why I like Adam Clark, Dr. Adam Clark, another great, just brilliant person. But he was the first person to really put it clearly. He goes, listen, Tim, it's not Christianity. It's Christianities. And which one do we want to participate in?
That's right.
And that was such an epiphany. I'm like, you know what? I want to be a part of the liberation. Where is Jesus found in the in the identity of the black body that's lynched? And how do we say no more? Because we're crucifying Jesus, the Imago Dei, every time we do that. I want to be part of that tradition, not the one that goes, hey, guys, the Bible's clear. The races need to stay separate so we continue to stay in power. One, and I'm speaking in our context, of course, there's more than one, but in this binary, so to speak, one side seems a little more concerned about maintaining their access to power and privilege by weaponizing God as justification for it. And the other seems more concerned about who are these oppressive systems actually impacting, right? And how do we use our privilege and give it away for the sake of the other that wants to love our neighbor better than we did yesterday? I want to choose the latter, Christianity, not the former. And I grew up in the former. And my last thought, I know we're running out of time, but just kind of bringing this full circle. You said something earlier that was like, I was like, oh, that's the connection where you said something to the effect of like, you know, how people see James Cone as a heretic, right?
Yeah.
Once again, who sets who's a heretic, right? Yep. And again, in our moment, I'm like, you know, even this idea of theology, why is it not white theology or black theology? Why is it black liberation theology and then just theology? Why is that? Why is there no adjective for that term, right? What's the standard view of theology, or even what is a proper hermeneutic? By whose standard, according to whose theology? Those are the questions that I think we weren't allowed to ask ourselves, that maybe the overlap slightly is this deconstruction view of philosophy that gave us permission to examine PNX and say, well, why are they even constants to begin with in our religious tradition?
And that's where, and this is a great place.
How'd I do? Kind of,
freaking killed it, man. Thousand points to you. before we take a quick break here from our sponsor and come back and close out with some camping questions for you.
Right. You got to break in a half hour. We put right through it.
This is what happens when you're at the campfire. This is like the most authentic one yet, right?
I love it.
But no, I think what you said is so important is, and this brings us back to what is deconstruction philosophically and religiously?
Yeah.
Both are, how is it that we can be more responsible by becoming more responsive? And in doing that work, part of what I find so compelling about philosophical deconstruction is it helped me understand that there were always Christianities, like there were always different conceptions of what we mean by truth. Doesn't mean that we've now just gotten rid of the concept of truth. Different ways of making sense of selfhood doesn't mean that we're just abandoning the notion of self. These false dichotomies between objectivist absolutism or naive, grotesque, incoherent, self-contradictory relativism, that itself is a binary that we should probably reject. Once we do that, for me, that's why religious deconstruction wasn't part of my story.
Right.
It's because I was doing this as a philosopher such that the thing wasn't the church that had to be deconstructed. It was like, man, it sucks that the way this is so often understood is so limited in light of this unbelievably complicated and dynamic and rich traditions that we could draw upon in multiple ways. And the last thing I'll say on that is, you know, Bonhoeffer talks about religionless Christianity. Kierkegaard said he's bringing Christianity back to Christendom. Simone Weil basically refuses to get baptized as a Catholic because of her commitment to the God that she finds in the tradition. Martin Luther King says, I have a dream, and his dream is anchored in his religious tradition.
Right.
But he also writes letter to from Birmingham jail against the white pastors who are saying, hey, your tradition doesn't look the right way, man. Like, this is a long, complicated set of discourses. And which voices get privileged and which voices get marginalized? Who becomes the heretic and who becomes the priest? Those are themselves part of what philosophically people like Jacques Derrida help us understand. And then in popular culture, people like you and our buddy Tripp and others have been trying to, I think, rightly help people realize moving away from what you were taught doesn't mean moving away from religion, moving away from the concept of God.
Right.
It just means recognizing that there are other ways to make sense of these things that you were taught had to be understood this way.
And frankly, if people want to leave faith, they're allowed to, right? Obviously, you
know
that's
also entirely
right. Right. But for our purpose, it's the same thing. It's like, hey, let's explore the rooms. You know, there's a lot more going on here. It's actually way more beautiful than you ever imagined. So let's go exploring, right? So yeah, I agree.
And here I will recommend, though, for what it's worth, book. I've got lots of critique of it. Tom Ord and Trip Fuller recently wrote a book called God After Deconstruction. I think that it is overblown in its commitment to process theology and doesn't allow for enough other relational models. I also think
you can't critique your friends online, Aaron. It's bad form. I'm telling you, Trip. I'm going to text Trip and Tom. I'm going to put all three of us in a group chat and blow you up with you in the group chat.
Like, that's right. I'm going to get
all the shit on your book. Did you know that?
All the trolling is coming. So yeah, everybody likes the YouTube so that they control it. That's but funny. Do check out their book, God After Deconstruction. I find it an amazing resource for lots of folks who do not understand what possibly remains for Christianity after leaving some of the confines they've grown up in. So, all right. So let's hear a very quick word from our sponsor, and then we're going to come back and close out by seeing where Tim wants to camp and with whom. We'll be right back. I hope you are enjoying Campfire Philosophy. I would like to take a moment to thank PlankSip for sponsoring the show. Daniel Sanderson is the guy behind that media outlet, and he is a fellow lover of philosophy. So if you get a chance, head over to PlankSip.org. That's PlankSip.org. If you sign up for their ideal plan and use the offer code Aaron, that's A-A-R-O-N, you will get 50% off for the first 6 months. Free book publishing and lots more. Go check them out. And thanks so much to Daniel and PlankSip for sponsoring Campfire Philosophy. Now, back to the show. So yes, definitely want to make sure that we take a minute to thank PlankSip, thank Dan for all his work supporting and producing the show. Really, really, really do appreciate it. All right, so we're going to make tonight's show a little bit shorter since there's only two of us. And also, this is one of those conversations that Tim and I recognize whatever we talk about, whether it be Blink 182 or God, the conversations rarely find a kind of logical end point. We just have to say, all right, we're gonna stop here,
and my wife would come in upset that I didn't get off the phone an hour like I told her,
gotta stop
screaming. Yeah, exactly,
that's right. So we're gonna shut it down here. Maybe we can come back together and do another bonus episode this fall, even after the series of Campfire Philosophy with Aaron Simmons ends. So
Aaron, I'm gonna help you out here, because again, this is a content pro tip for you as an influencer that you are. Friends, if you want to see a bonus episode of me coming back on this show, put it in the YouTube comments. I want more of Tim. And if I get enough of them, I will bring Tim back on the show. See, that's how you do it. You got to drive engagement to people interacting with your social medias and your YouTubes. And that's what gets the engagement. You're welcome. You're welcome for that. It's a freebie.
There you go. Drop it in. Let me know you want to see Tim again, and I will make sure to get him back in here. All right. So we are going to close out tonight with our five questions and then make sure we can get Tim in so his wife is not mad at him. All right, Tim. Five questions we always ask to close out our shows. Beach or mountains? Which one?
Gosh. Indoor air conditioning.
So if we could find the mountain lodge that's got some good air conditioning.
Good. I would take that. I'm not a big beach guy. Sand everywhere, sun everywhere. Okay. Not my thing. So we'll go with mountains, I guess.
Mountains with air conditioning. Yes. I like that. While we are by the campfire, of course, in this case, maybe it's like one of these really fancy lodges that has like the outdoor area with the campfire right next to the hot tub. And
now
I feel your vibe, right?
Now you're talking. Exactly.
Hot chocolate, hot tea, or coffee? What's your drink of choice by the campfire? Bro,
we all know it is 7-Eleven blueberry coffee every time for days. Yummy.
Oh, my goodness. See, though we've been critiquing binaries, I'm pretty sure that you either like good things or you like 7-Eleven coffee.
No.
I think that might be the
I'm all binary about binaries. Thing. This is superior coffee and nothing else compares. The end. Objective truth stated.
So we'll put, as philosophers would say, quod ergo demonstratus, thus it is proved. Mic drop with that claim.
I think you just spoke in tongues there, but yeah, sure. That.
I'm Pentecostal, brother.
Shyamalan,
number
bro.
Three. Number three. When you're drinking your blueberry coffee from 7-Eleven by the fancy campfire with the hot tub and air conditioning, what is your favorite food over the campfire? It can't be s'mores.
Oh, you know, I think a fire roasted hot dog, they just taste better, man.
Yeah.
They just taste. I don't know what it is. Something about the open flame, the char, they just taste top tier.
I entirely agree. And it's been now over a decade. My wife and I were vegan for a long time. And then we stopped being vegan. We added chicken and turkey and fish and stuff back in our diet, but didn't go back to pork and beef. And so even turkey dogs are way better over the campfire. I believe. So I'm entirely with you.
There's some kind of magic going on there.
Yeah. Number four, you and I are both musicians. We are drummers, which means that we're only kind of like musician adjacent.
Yeah, right. We're wannabe musicians. Exactly.
What do you call somebody who hangs out with musicians? Man hit thing with
sticks and make good sound, you know?
Which works at campfires, right?
Totally.
I was once, in fact, told by John Caputo that me and my friends that were critical of his work, we were all sitting around the campfire beating our chests and complaining about his views. And I told him, Jack, I think that might not be the best metaphor to use in the response to me. Right. So we changed, we kind of massaged it to make it slightly less patronizing, It was still feisty. So yeah, please know it was still very critical.
Maybe I'll get him on and have him critique you publicly.
He's such a good friend. Absolutely lay in traffic for that guy. He's been wonderful to me. But yes, his earliest critique of my work was not just unkind, but it was like throat punching, which is amazing. Okay. Yeah. I to this day am like, man, that guy's such a rock star, such a big fan. All right. Number four, we are musicians-ish. What song do you want played while sitting by the campfire eating your charred hot dog, drinking your coffee?
The problem is it depends on the mood, right? We obviously have the classic acoustic guitar feel on the campfire. It's all sentimental.
Right,
but bro,
right.
I'm a drummer. I like aggressive. I like fat backbeat. I like punch you in your throat or your gut or somewhere else if you got them. You know what I'm saying? Like, I just punch you hard. Honestly, yep. I can go for anything. I think like some real, like almost like Snarky Puppy instrumental, just like jazz funk fusion. You're just laying into it. Man. But if I'm really feeling it, we'll go full on Dirty Loops, bro. Just put on Loops best of and just let them fucking go.
Crushing it. Now, here's what's awesome. Tim and I, for everybody listening, in all seriousness, have been talking for a couple years now about the logistics of what it would look like to put on some sort of camping with Kierkegaard New Evangelicals retreat.
That could be fun.
And to like end up in the mountains. So can you imagine like everything we're describing being a literal reality? That is also a thing. Drop comments. Let us know so that we can.
Yay, Aaron, you're doing it. Yes, that's it. That's it. You picked up.
I'm so bad at self-promotion. All right. So for me tonight, in honor of my New Jersey guest, I'm wearing my Gaslight Anthem t-shirt. And so I would actually listen to some Brian Fallon music. Maybe Too Much Blood on the Page, I think, would be a pretty good acoustic jam by the campfire with you.
Fair enough.
Last question. You could take one philosopher or theologian camping with you, alive or dead. Who do you take to the campsite?
It's got
to
be you.
Oh, my goodness.
I'm being serious. Because you know what? One of your gifts, I think, and again, I'm no academic, so maybe I'm wrong, is that you can explain complicated philosophical jargon in layman's terms. I can say, Aaron, make this simple. And like, here you go. I'll use some common language. Now, it's still complicated. I still am like, whoa, my brain is being twisted, but I can comprehend it. Just because I like you, John Caputo, if you're listening, this book, very hard to read for us very lay folks. Okay. Just letting you know.
Deconstruction in a nutshell. It's a big old nutshell.
I'm trying, John. I'm really trying to get it. But bro, what are we talking about? But no, for real, I think that, who knows if this will ever be a reality, but I do think the idea at least of, let me just say, I hate camping. I don't camp. Okay. But that's why I need to go. I need to get out my circle and get uncomfortable and go with a pro like yourself. But if it was you, me, and like maybe five or 10 people, in a very like, you know, doable camping trip for like maybe two nights, mm-hmm. 3 days total, where we had time to sit around a campfire, no phones, we're disconnected, just right. us and the stars. All Man, in. That could be freaking cool. So again, I can't guarantee it, friends. We're not announcing anything, but it could be a thought for the future for us at least. Could be cool.
That'd be so fun.
And because we're celebrities, we charge a very reasonable rate, about $5,000 a person. You know, that covers our glamping fees, our first class airfare, private jet, etc. Yeah.
Let me make very clear that when I go camping, it's, you know, truck camping, like the tents are on the ground. When I go backpacking, I'm not ultra light, but it's still pretty light. So there is no, like, you know, pocket air conditioning unit that I'm carrying with myself or pop-up hot tub. Right. So the price point for the New Evangelicals Camping with Kierkegaard retreat is entirely a result of one Tim Whitaker. Let me make clear.
Well, listen, I know we got a jet, but I just to be clear about this, I would definitely go with you, even though I would absolutely hate the idea of going camping, knowing it's for my own good to do it. But it could be a good time for real. And I'm a total amateur. I'd be like, Aaron, how do you set up the tent? Like, what do I do? How do I cook food? What does it mean to carry light? I don't freaking know. So as long as you're cool having a literal man child with you while you go camping, have a good time.
Well, and my choice tonight is somebody you mentioned earlier, again, a mutual friend who I think would be amazing to have by the campfire with us, and that's Adam Clark. So I think when we go,
Adam Clark,
let's bring Adam. And yeah, I mean, what a freaking fun night. Well, Tim, this has been absolutely so much fun. It's one of those hours that you kind of look at and you think, man, if all my hours went this way, life would go way too quick, right?
Seriously. Definitely a good conversation. Thanks for having me.
But dude, great. This has been so wonderful. To everybody, thank you all so, so, so much for joining me on another episode of Campfire Philosophy with J. Aaron Simmons. Please do check out my book, Camping with Kierkegaard. It's available in audio form.
What is worthy of your finitude? Go find
out. Question to ask. And then also please jump over to my Substack, Philosophy in the Wild. Get connected with me there. Paid and free subscriptions available. So as you're doing that, make sure to check out the New Evangelicals, my buddy Tim Whitaker. Amazing, amazing work. I will see you guys next time on Campfire Philosophy with J. Aaron Simmons.
This is
on the trail, for hiking with me a few miles more, for casting out your line into waters in which we both stand, for dropping in at the top and fist bumping me at the bottom, and for coming camping with me and Kierkegaard. Our time together has been so very worthy of my finitude. I hope it was worthy of yours.